Let's face it, evangelism can be a scary endeavor, especially in this culture. Do you ever feel handcuffed when it comes to sharing the gospel? Well, if so, let me introduce you to a crash course on evangelism that I have created for you in order to eliminate the fears so that you could do evangelism in a conversational way, in a way that's relatable, in a way that can resonate with 21st century America. In this 7-part course, you will also have the opportunity to be invited in to a Facebook group whereby you can meet other people who have some of the same obstacles to overcome that you might have, and you can connect with them and find a network there. I hope you'll join us in this 7-week journey to doing outreach, the Great Commission for Jesus Christ.
Enroll today at oneminuteapologist.com/courses. When answering the question, why do we have a sense of ought, whose explanation makes more sense, Charles Darwin or the God of the Bible? We discuss that on this episode of Unapologetic, where we defend truth without compromise with Dr. Bobby Conway, the 1-Minute Apologist. I'm your host, Tim Hall. Bobby, playing off our episode last week where we talked about Halloween, so if anyone missed that episode, you can go back and look at that. But we talked a lot about, you know, these things that we should and shouldn't do. And Today we're really going to kind of dive deep into some of your work that you did for your PhD on morality, particularly the argument for God's existence or for moral realism based on guilt. And so in your work, you looked at several different kind of options, and one of them we want to contrast Darwin's view of how he deals with guilt and Yahweh's view, how he ultimately deals with guilt. So let's kind of dive into this and talk a little bit about Darwin. So let's kind of try to make Darwin's argument for him. How would he deal with something like feelings of guilt or actual guilt or that kind of thing?
Charles Darwin's breakthrough book was The Origin of the Species, mm-hmm. published in 1859.
Yep.
A little over a decade later, he wrote The Descent of Man, mm-hmm. and it was in The Descent of Man where he sought to take his naturalistic understanding of how we evolve by natural selection, and he sought to provide an account for morality, and he wanted to show where this inner moral sense came from.
Yeah.
And so for Darwin, he basically contended that mankind is different than all other animals.
Yeah.
That's a clear distinction mm-hmm. that he wanted to make. And what makes us unique is the fact that we have this moral sense.
Yeah.
And to account for our moral sense, Darwin attributes a couple factors.
Okay.
Number one, our ability to reflect. And number two, the fact that we have rational capacity.
Okay.
And so what takes place in his line of thought is we become moral because we experience this sense of guilt.
Okay.
What he would refer to as regret.
Mm-hmm.
And we would experience regret after a moral failure. And we would reflect on that moral failure, and we would reflect on the guilt that we felt. And using our reasoning capacity, we would then create a way to avoid doing the same action that caused us guilt. So if you had this sense of guilt that came upon after, you know, partaking in a particular action, and you felt this remorse or this regret or what I would call guilt,
yeah.
Well, what you would do is you would reflect, this action caused this feeling.
Yeah.
And therefore, using your reasoning capacity, you would construct a better way forward to avoid that kind of feeling in the future.
So you gave an example in the book that I believe Darwin drew on with a sparrow leaving its young ones to, you know, follow the instinct of migration. So unpack that a little bit for us, 'cause I thought it was an excellent point.
Yeah, so given the migration path that a sparrow would take,
mm-hmm.
suppose a sparrow had some young, and the sparrow was there with the young, nursing the young, but what does the sparrow do? leaves and migrates.
Right.
Well, Darwin contests that if the sparrow could wake up to the horror of what it just did, it left its young in its nest, it would be overcome. But because the sparrow does not have reflective capacity and reasoning abilities, the sparrow can continue on in its migratory route. Okay. A parent, though, would leave its child and they would be disrupted by regret, remorse, and guilt. And that would cause them to stay close to the nest unless they were a psychopath of some sort.
Right. Okay, so that's kind of one component of it. You go on to talk a little bit about this reflexive capacity on guilt, but you break it down into another category where you're talking about societal, kind of pressures, if you will, societal guilt. So talk to a little bit about that, where, we desire to kind of have esteem, be esteemed by our fellow man or by the people in society. And so that's going to play a role in the decisions that we make when we reflect back on some of those decisions. And then that becomes kind of, like our moral standard or what we should be doing. Explain that for us.
Well, it sounds a little bit like a social contract.
Okay.
And so you have these different societies, you have a culture. Mm. And any time that you set about to find a civilization and create culture, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to come up with different styles of work for people to have. You're going to create arts. And so you're going to have the artist, doing art and the musicians doing music, and you're going to come up with your own foods and your own language. But you also have to have a sort of a social contract by which you agree to live by.
Okay.
And to not lose esteem with your fellow peers, you need to hold fast to that contract.
Okay.
And so your moral motivation then becomes one in which you seek to retain the esteem of others. Mm-hmm. The problem with this is morality becomes very relative. Now, Darwin recognized this, and this gets back to your opening question, this sense of ought, like, why ought I to do something? I ought to do something because this particular culture says I ought to.
Right.
But the culture next door says I ought not to do it, while this particular culture says I ought to do it.
Yeah.
And so how do we arbitrate between these two cultures? The one culture that says it's good, the one culture that says it's bad.
Okay.
Your motivation is I don't want to lose esteem.
Yeah.
But then you're just morally motivated so that you can be perceived a certain way.
Okay.
And so you could recognize how unfruitful that is for a true moral society. And not only that, you can imagine if you had a passport, so to speak, to go in and out of these cultures. When in Vegas, you can live in Vegas.
Right.
And so you're just a morally confused person.
Right.
Your geography tames you, or you're tamed by, retaining a sense of esteem by others. But is there not something bigger that carries the weight of this? And really what Darwin did, Tim, is he adopted the utilitarianism of his day.
Okay.
Nietzsche would later hammer this idea, because for Nietzsche, he took natural selection to its logical ends.
Right.
For Nietzsche, why be moral?
Yeah.
Why even bother with it? Natural selection doesn't create moral people.
Yeah.
The purpose of natural selection is survival, not morality. And so for Nietzsche, you needed to kind of determine your own reality.
Yeah.
You needed to be kind of the Superman. You needed to overpower and kind of be that Ubermensch and the overcomer and create your own reality. So for him, it was very postmodern, right? So he's kind of the father of postmodernity, where there is no real right and wrong, where Darwin's trying to get at it through these cultural mechanisms of esteem. Well, what happens when you're in a particular religious context, right?
Right.
Well, for Nietzsche, this was very much a problem. You needed to get freed from the priestly caste and their religious ways. For Nietzsche, religion was just a way to perpetually keep people bound up by their guilt so that they could be forced to obey their governing authorities.
Mm.
Now, when you hear some of these things at first glance, there can be a morsel of truth in it, right?
Right.
Like take Darwin, for example. Do we get instructed through reflection and because we're rational creatures? I'd say yes. But we also have a built-in mechanism given to us by God called the conscience that helps us to arbitrate between right and wrong.
So I know that Darwin's answer would basically be natural selection, right? So, but does he give any sort of account in your readings and Descent of Man or Origin of Species about how this moral sense or being able to reflect back on things came about? Like, to me, it doesn't seem advantageous when it comes to science or survival or whatnot. Like you were saying, you know, Nietzsche's perspective was more, you know, kind of the Übermensch, right? So how does he account for it feeling like it isn't the Übermensch to be compassionate and reflective and whatnot?
Well, for Darwin, again, this is completely manufactured by cultures. And so each culture helps dictate what that moral sense will be. Mm. And so that's the way you create a coherent society. So he recognized the need for morality. You'll have some that would, you know, say, you know, we don't even need to be moral. It's right. So subjective. Who are you to tell me what is right and wrong?
Yeah.
You know, you have other people that would want to say things like morality is just an illusion. It's been fobbed off on us to right. cause us, you know, to be tamed as humans. Yeah. This would be Michael Ruse. And so I think that the idea of morality, the question even bigger, why be moral? Mm. Are we to be moral because our particular culture says so?
Yeah.
Are we to be moral because, you know, the religious class says so? Mm. Are we to be moral according to what we deem right and wrong in and of ourselves? You got one chance to live, so why bother taming ourselves? I mean, Freud, for example, he saw the church doing a great disservice to people's sexual cravings. And yeah. He felt that the church stifled sexual cravings, and he believed that part of the problem that we had is we needed to get freed up from the shackles of this Victorian view of sexuality, and we need to express ourselves. And so how is it that we arrive at what is right and what is wrong? And I think Christianity gives us a great answer. And I don't even think we need to go all the way to Christianity. I think we can arrive at theism by the instrument of our conscience. And we can philosophically argue from guilt to theism. And we can recognize that, you know what? Guilt tells us some things. It tells us some things that we ought to listen to.
Mm. So, okay, so let's unpack some of that. So we kind of have Darwin, you've kind of set the stage here of what Darwin's primary explanation was. So if you're, you know, in your work, you kind of go in and dismantle some of these pieces. So hopefully you can unpack some of that for us today. So why is Yalways, why is the theist position more reasonable or have better evidence to it than Darwin's, you know, moral sense coming about by natural selection?
This is what philosophers refer to as the grounding issue in moral philosophy. How do we ground, you know, what we ought to do?
Yeah.
Where does our moral ought come from? I ought to do this. I ought not to do that. Mm-hmm. Where does that come from? And so the problem with making it culturally based is you end up in cultural chaos. Again, one culture says this is right, another culture says this is wrong. What you end up with is relativism. Okay. And so there's no real way to ground objectively right and wrong. And so by objective, I mean something is always right or wrong, even if I disagree with the fact that it is right or wrong.
Okay.
That moral standard retains regardless of how I think about it. So if I think it's okay to cut open a pregnant woman's stomach and take out the baby and dismantle it, if I think that's okay, what I'm saying is it is objectively wrong, regardless of the fact that you think it is okay. That is because I believe you can ground morality in a real right and wrong. So where then do we arrive at goodness? And I would say goodness is grounded in the good nature of God, right? So God is the one who we look to as the source of what is right and wrong. So take, for example, guilt.
Yeah.
What does guilt tell us? Well, when we sin, we feel guilt, okay. Right? Guilt comes as a result of sin. We feel guilty. Now, guilt has feelings that can be subjective, but those feelings can be objective as well, insofar as our feelings correspond to a moral violation.
Okay.
So if I feel guilty for stealing a TV that I never stole, my guilt feelings are subjective. But if I feel guilty for stealing a TV that I really did steal, my guilt feelings are objective because my guilt feelings correspond to the objective fact that I stole that TV.
Okay.
Now, when I feel guilty, it seems as if I've offended someone.
Right.
Right. And as Christians, we would say that that someone is God.
Okay.
It feels personal. Now, in order to be offended, it requires a personal being.
Okay.
An abstract object, like on Platonism, abstract objects do not get offended. they aren't offended. It takes a personal being to be offended by our moral violation. So we're saying that God is one who can be offended because God is one who is personal. Not only that, from guilt, we can extract the fact that God is good. Why is it, Tim, that whenever we feel guilty, it's because we have done something wrong?
Okay.
So for those that would say, well, what if God is a capricious God, a malevolent bully, right? To use the language of Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
I would want to say that there's something of a hint to God's goodness in our guilt. There's a goodness to our guilt in that it shows us that there is a good God. It's as if God is our tutor when we do something wrong, and he gets at us through the instrument of guilt. Mm. We feel guilty, and what we can then learn is guilt can be a teacher. Don't do this because this goes against God's good nature.
Okay.
We can also learn that God is the moral law giver.
Right.
He's the one who gives the moral laws to us.
Right.
He sets what is right and wrong. We can get into the Euthyphro dilemma if you choose.
Yeah.
And so these are just some of the aspects. Not only that, we can know that God is fit to hold us accountable. We can know that God is all-knowing. Why is it that guilt is something that is systemic? It's universal, that all cultures are familiar with guilt.
Yeah.
Well, it takes an all-knowing God to hold people accountable. It's not as if God is partially knowing and he only knows about certain continents and their guilt, and he doesn't have the rational capacity to absorb what took place in another continent.
Right.
He's an omniscient being who knows about all of our guilt, which makes him fit to hold all of us accountable as the moral lawgiver who is good.
Mm. So as I was reading some of your PhD work, which is excellent, by the way,
Thank you.
One of the things that kept coming up is Sam Harris's view. So Sam Harris's view, I think, you know, kind of dovetails a little bit on Darwin's view in the sense that he has this, you know, objective nature by saying harm. If you harm another individual, that's something that we all share. All humans share this, you know, not wanting to get harmed, right? And we can then have objective standards to say whether or not we harm somebody. We can measure that. So in his way of thinking, in Sam Harris's way of thinking, he would say, well, that's where objectivity of morality comes in, is in the objective standards that we can use to judge harm. So how would you know, guilt respond to something like that? How would your argument of guilt respond to someone like Sam Harris?
Well, I think there's a problem with the sadomasochist meets the masochist. Okay. So, I mean,
sounds like a good book.
Yeah. It sounds like a good book. Right. But, you know, harm can also, you have people that are corrupt. I mean, I remember reading the story about a person who put out an ad asking for somebody to come and fulfill this individual's fantasy of murdering him. And guess what? You had several people offer to kill the person.
Wow.
And somebody ultimately did, causing this person harm. I suppose Harris could rebut by saying, well, that's not real harm in the sense that that person didn't consider it harmful.
Mm.
But do you see how subjective this begins to get?
Right.
How are we going to define harm, I would ask Sam Harris.
Yeah.
And then he's going to create what? Some objective standards by which we can determine what is harmful and what is not.
Yeah.
Well, some people would say it's harmful for somebody who's 25 to have sex with a 15-year-old.
Mm.
You have other people who would say that's not harmful.
Right.
You would have even our long history where it'd be very normal for a 25-year-old to right. take a 15-year-old and sleep with that person. Right. We just happen to have a culture that says at 18, it's no longer harmful, but the day before when they were 17, it was harmful.
Right.
So you can see how subjective this gets.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So I mean, there's so many different places we could go with this. So one of the moral argument for several people as we talk to them, and I'd just love to get your thoughts on this because you and I have talked about this a little bit before. So objectivity, I think, has a few definitions to it. You gave one before about it being, you know, in a sense, absolute, but not changing, not dependent on human individuals. With that, would you also add that it's grounded in a being of God? Is that part of the definition of objectivity, is that it's grounded in an object, that the person of God?
I would, but you would have people like Eric Wielenberg, who's an atheist, and he would seek to come up with a viewpoint on atheism of objective morality.
Yeah.
And he would seek to ground morality in the Platonic realm. Mm. Now, that might sound abstract, and that's because it is.
It is.
We're talking about abstract objects.
Right.
But for Wielenberg, he would state that there are these free-floating, virtuous, abstract objects okay. like kindness or virtue. And they have a way of affecting us.
Yeah, like impressing upon us.
Yes.
Okay.
They have a way of impressing us. And we are seeking to conform to this abstract realm of virtues. Mm. But in my opinion, why bother trying to obey these abstract, morally effete objects that are indifferent to how I live, number one, that number two could never hold me accountable, and number three, they can't be offended. Mm. So yes, I think that you could make a case as Wielenberg does, and I commend him for striving to do that.
Yeah.
I'm much more thankful for Wielenberg's approach than I am for Nietzsche's approach. Yeah. I think that a Wielenberg society would produce a much better society than a Nietzschean society mm. or a Freudian society. But I think that a Christian society produces a better society than even a Wielenberg society.
Okay, so I have one more question that we'll try to answer in the next few minutes here before we wrap up. But there's an atheist YouTuber named Alex O'Connor. He goes by the Cosmic Skeptic. He, you know, has several videos on morality. But one of the questions that he asked that I'm posing to you right now is, why ought we be good in that sense? Why ought we follow the moral law? So in a sense, it's like, why ought we ought, right, is really yes. what he's saying. And so even if God, you know, God's goodness is grounded in his nature, and, you know, but why should we follow that? Why should we follow the rules of, you know, the cosmic creator, if you will? How would you answer that question?
A number of things. Number one, I want to please God.
Okay.
Number two, I don't want the consequences that come without pleasing God.
Okay.
Number three, I'm accountable to God. Number four, I believe that having a sense of ought does produce a better culture.
Okay.
I believe that it tames us. Guilt, I would liken to a shock collar.
Okay.
My dog Winston drives me up a wall. He's a cute little English bulldog.
He so is.
But he is obnoxious as all gets out. He drives me crazy. And the dog will just start barking for no reason. He thinks he's a real estate mogul that needs to protect our property.
Okay.
And anything that he sees, he just starts barking at it. I kid you not, Tim, there was a time when he was barking at shadows.
Oh my goodness.
Well, in order to kind of taper this down, we invested in, I highly recommend it, a shock collar.
Okay.
And it
for your dog, not
works.
Your kids, everybody.
Yeah, for your dog and not your kids. Well, you might want to get one for your kids. No. But this works. It helps curb him from barking. I think guilt curbs us.
Okay.
Can you imagine a world? I remember reading H.G. Wells' Invisible Man.
Mm-hmm.
And Invisible Man tells the story about this scientist who figures out a way to make himself invisible. And then he starts pulling off all of these malicious acts like murder, and he becomes much more base in his actions, and he can't figure out how to become visible again until finally he dies and now he's visible again.
Mm.
Well, I've often thought, what if we could become invisible?
Mm.
How much more morbid would we be?
Yeah.
Or how more evil would we be if we did not feel guilt?
Right.
Guilt has a taming, it's like a shock collar to culture. being invisible would not serve us well. It's good that we have an all-knowing God who can see us. And so I can also say this, Tim. I was a reprobate. I lived a very promiscuous life. I used a lot of hard drugs. I was an alcoholic who ended up in AA, had a relapse 23 years later, ended up back in AA. Mm-hmm. I know what it was like to lie, to steal, to cheat, to argue with my parents, to be a high school runaway.
Yeah.
I know what it was like to get in tons of trouble. And here's what I can tell you. That was not a rewarding lifestyle. Mm. And if I could go back to living that way again, I would not want to do that. Yeah. I believe that there's a better way to treat humanity. So not only am I morally motivated to please God, I'm morally motivated to love others, and I'm morally motivated to put some proper boundaries up in my life. And I believe that God has given us the best boundaries worth living for.
Well, that is amazing. Well, hopefully for you, the listener, we are able to keep this at a level that you could understand it. Some of the illustrations that we gave, we tried to keep them real world and practical. But if you want to check out this episode again, because you were listening to it on the radio and you're just like, man, I didn't catch all that, you could head on over to youtube.com/oneminuteapologist and select the playlist of the unapologetic episodes and check it out again. With that, we will meet you next time on The Unapologetic Show. You've been listening to Unapologetic with Dr. Bobby Conway, the One-Minute Apologist. I am your host, Tim Hall. Be sure to listen to Bobby on Pastor's Perspective Monday through Thursday, as well as like, share, and subscribe to the One-Minute Apologist YouTube channel, where we have over 1,000 videos. We would also like to remind you that this is a listener-supported program. We would greatly appreciate your support in any amount so we could continue to provide this ministry. If you would like to be a part of our team in any capacity, please visit our website at oneminuteapologist.com. And while you're there, check out all of Bobby's books, courses, and even invite him to speak at your church or event. Thank you for listening to Unapologetic, where we defend truth without compromise. This program is sponsored by Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa.